Good afternoon. Happy Sabbath. Happy Passover. It's not here yet. But how many of you are already thinking about it and looking forward to it? You've been all right. Sort of get a little feast excitement. I want to say hello to those who are watching. I know what it's like to be at home and to be watching, so we're glad you could join us today. I also want to echo what was said about the musicians who are over here, how much we appreciate you guys, and the girl, the young lady, who's also up there and playing. I was thinking that instead of three violins, and I haven't noticed, do one of you play a viola? You do. Okay, and then today we had a cello that was here, and I thought we just need a bass. Turned out we actually sort of have a bass, because I noticed the harp was doing the deeper notes that were there being plucked, and that fills in, really does. It's very nice that you do that, Mrs. McCready, that you have that. I love those lower notes that you were doing. Just fills in for us. It gives a fuller, richer sound. So that's very nice. And I want to, I know you're looking forward to the Passover. How many of you are already making plans and thinking about the Feast of Tabernacles? Okay. Have you figured out where you're going? Where are you going?
Canada.
Panama City Beach. I'm going to say, what, which group are you with? Okay. You're going with your wife. Okay. I'm going with my wife. She'd like to go down to Mexico, to Puerto Vallarta. So we've been working on getting her a passport. She's never had one. And so, and her name got kind of changed through the years. Her name is actually Charlotte Renee, R-E-N-E, with an accent mark. That's her actual name, but then it all got changed in grammar school. So anyway, we're thinking about that. So we have applied for a passport for her. And so we're excited about that. And we're also excited about the Passover. And we've been reading things in preparation. And you've had some wonderful sermons here on the Passover. The one on forgiveness that was given by your pastor, and then the one on the Passover itself. We listened to both of those. So we have enjoyed preparing for the Passover ourselves. And we've been reading some of the verses. Are any of you already reading verses leading up to Passover? Been thinking about? You have? What have you guys been reading? You have? Yes. Do you mind? You can pass it on to your husband if you don't want to say. Yeah, no, you. The book of John. And as you go through, do you read the whole book of John or you start? Okay. That is. Of course, that was Passover night, and Gary Petty gave the best, the clearest, most detailed message on foot washing that I've ever heard. And I've given sermons on foot washing and gone into it, but he gave just a few weeks ago down in Nashville really excellent and some thoughts about foot washing that I'd never heard. So he gave a really fine one. It's on the, I would think it's on the internet by now if any of you are interested. But we enjoyed that. As I said, Mr. Barker's sermons that he's been giving. Any other scriptures you've been reading in preparation? Are any favorite ones that you like to read before the Passover? Yes, sir. Mr. Brewer, I love your name.
John 14, 15, 16, 17.
All right, very similar to what you were mentioning right there. And there's another chapter in John I think really is very instructive, thinking about the Passover. Anybody, any thoughts? John 6, where he said, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood. And the title of this message is Happy Passover. And my purpose today is to help us begin thinking about the Passover. And I appreciated Mr. Barker's comments that it is, I forget the words that he used, but it's not a morose, sad thing that when we look at the Passover. I mean, there was a time when we kept the Passover like he was actually going to be crucified that night. And we were miserable, and you couldn't talk to anybody, and you weren't supposed to say anything. I'm sure that the disciples and Jesus on that last night, they talked, and they drank wine. They drank more than we drink. They ate big meal, and you wonder, you know, say, well, why did those guys fall asleep that night while Jesus was praying? Because they'd had a big meal and a lot of wine. And, you know, now they were in their 30s, but when I was in my 30s, I could do that and stay awake. But I couldn't do that now. I mean, I'm 78, be 79, a couple of months. And boy, a big meal and lamb and the sop and here hand out a cup and say, drink you all of this. And I'd be ready for some sleep right away. Just to get up to the Mount of Olives would have been a bit of a struggle. Anyway, I want to encourage us all. And by the way, did we get the handouts? Everybody has a handout. You can see one of the places we're going. We probably will not get to the three. This is one passage, more than one verse. But besides this, there are two psalms that I like very much to read before the Passover. Now, Renee and I went through this right here, and then we went back and read the book of Exodus from chapter 1 up to chapter 20. And because all that was picturing us coming out of this world, our baptism. I mean, this is a renewal of our baptism. So it really is a happy time. And we think, well, Jesus went through a terrible, terrible sacrifice. And so when we go there, we think, boy, here we are celebrating, as in a sense, this our older brother who went through a terrible sacrifice for us, painful. Yet on the other hand, he is not going to be crucified Passover night. He has not suffered for 2,000 years. He's been sitting at the right hand of God the Father. And it says at God's right hand, there is pleasure forevermore. He asked God to glorify him. There in John 17 and verse 5, glorify me with the glory which I had with you, with yourself. Glorify me with yourself, with the glory which I had with you before the world was. So he's been in glory. He's been enjoying life. He's been serving. How does he look back to the Passover? Does he look back and think, man, that was awful? Or does he look back with joy for what he has done for us? I think he looks back with joy that he did it. He got through it. It's over. And it paid for our salvation. So I think he rejoices in the Passover, every Passover. I think God the Father rejoices in it. And I think we are picturing our baptism, the forgiveness. And, of course, the Days of Unleavened Bread, that we think it was on the last day of Unleavened Bread that they went through the Red Sea. You can't prove that, but when you look at how they journeyed from Ramses to Sukkoth, from Sukkoth to Etham, then they went 3 days' journey into the wilderness, and then Pharaoh found out and went with his chariots, which wouldn't have taken very long at all, that he would have shown up about the last day of unleavened bread. So the going through the Red Sea pictured our baptism and being delivered from Satan and Satan's world. Because Satan's, and I've heard this many times, and I've come more and more to believe that it is correct, that Satan is pictured by Pharaoh, and Egypt pictures Satan's world. And coming out of sin, God delivering us, isn't that all a joy and a happiness? So that's what we've read. We've also gone through, actually at services, we went through two of the Psalms, Psalm 32, which is one of my favorite Psalms. And actually, when I was first being converted and was baptized, and I don't know if we'll get to it today or not, but Psalm 32, and it's actually in the Hebrew, how happy is he whose sins are forgiven? Now it says blessed, but the word that's there, I'll just tell you, even before we get there, where it says blessed is the Hebrew word Esher. Now the Hebrew word Esher was the name of one of the 12 sons of Israel, of Jacob. And his mother said, oh, now that I've had him, my husband will love me and I'm happy. So she named her son Happy. You ever known anybody named Happy? Ash, I've known. Remember Happy Winches, any of you? Or Happy Rockefeller. You remember Happy Rockefeller? The wife, yes. Of Nelson Rockefeller was named Happy. I like that name. And I knew a young lady named Happy Winches, and she was a happy person. But so he was named Happy, which in the Hebrew is Esher, but in the King James they wrote it as Asher. But that's what's there, and many modern translations have translated verse 1 of Psalm 32. How happy is he whose sins are forgiven? So we may get to that today. We may not, because I'd like to cover this other passage that I gave you. And this is written in the Living Bible. Now, I think most of us have mixed feelings about the Living Bible. It's like the little girl who was, when she was good, she was very, very good. And when she was bad, she was horrid. Remember that? What was the name of the little girl? I don't remember. But, don't know. Anyway, that's about the way the Living Bible is. Where it is good, it is very, very good. And where it is bad, it is horrid. But I think it gives you a flavor. I think the King James, the New King James, it does a really good job of being close to the Hebrew. But it's always good to have other translations, because sometimes being close to the Hebrew doesn't give you the idiomatic meaning that the Hebrew had. So sometimes, this is actually poetry. This is Hebrew poetry. And it has meter, and Hebrew poetry is reflective, and that is it's called parallelism. How many of you have ever heard that, of parallelism? All right, when we have poetry, sometimes we make it rhyme and sometimes we don't. Some poetry doesn't rhyme, but you know, you how now brown cow, we rhyme things. But other times we will just say something twice in a little different way. That's called parallelism. If any of you love the blues, anybody like the blues? Some of you, you like the blues? Okay. Blues will normally say the same thing twice in the first, at the beginning. Woke up this morning, you know my head was feeling dead. Yeah, woke up this morning, you know my head was feeling dead. Now see, it said it twice. And then it answers the question. Looked around for my baby. She was gone and that is bad. You know, I mean, that answers it. So, but you got to say the first verse twice. I just made that up, by the way. That's, and you're probably thinking, yeah, you're, okay. See you down at BB's Saloon. But in Hebrew poetry, often as you went through it, it would say the same thing twice. The Lord is the one who rescues me. My God takes me out of trials. So you're saying the same thing twice, only you just change the words a little bit. And you see that throughout the Psalms. You see it throughout. Sometimes it will be reverse parallelism. The wise man does this good thing. The fool does this bad thing. That's Hebrew poetry parallelism. And a lot of times when you read the Hebrew poetry, they use hyperbole. Now, you may not have used the word hyperbole, but it's what we call exaggeration for emphasis. It's poetic. For instance, you say in a song, you say, "Honey, I'll get the moon for you." Well, nobody believes that literally. But you understand what the person means. Or in the song, "You shake my nerves and you rattle my brain. You drive me insane." How many of you remember that song?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Then you take the piano and you go, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis. Now, that's not literal. And a lot of the things that Jesus, he told parables. And they weren't literal all the time. We wonder sometimes if some of them were literal, but we are not sure. So that's a lot of Hebrew poetry. And it is an analogy. It's a metaphor. And so you see in the Psalms, it talks about how the trees clap hands and all of the fish rejoice and all the clouds rejoice and, you know, whatever else it is. The hills skip like lambs, which they may actually do literally. Sometimes you wonder, is that going to be literal or is it just figurative? So you see that in Hebrew poetry. This is Hebrew poetry. Now, sometimes in Hebrew poetry, they will start off and say something in the parallelism. And they will have little parallelisms and say the same thing twice in a different way. But then it will talk about something. Then it will have another one, like this is A. Then it will have more B. And then it will have section C. Now it's going to go back and have section B. It's going to be parallel with that second section. And then you'll have section A is the fifth one, which is parallel to the first one. Now, I know you didn't come here to learn all about Hebrew poetry, but it just so happens that they didn't realize that when they translated the King James. Or let's say, not the King James, but when they actually put chapters and verses. But if you will look in your Bible, most of the time, you'll see where sometimes the writing is, the printing is justified on both ends. That is, it's flat on the left side, but it's also flat on the right. It goes straight. And that's prose. But then sometimes it doesn't go all the way because they know it's poetry. So they divide it into poetry. You'll notice that when you read a lot of the book of Isaiah or the Psalms, which are basically all poetry set to music. Well, it just so happens that Isaiah 53 has 12 verses. But they came to realize that the last three verses of Isaiah 52 were part of this Hebrew poetry parallelism. It makes 15 verses. 15 verses. You see them here. It's 15 verses. And that's exactly the way it is in the Hebrew. And the first three verses of this, of the 15, are the last three verses of Isaiah 52, verses 13 through 15. And the meaning of those first three verses are, the meaning is, the Messiah is sacrificed, then exalted. Now, exalted in two ways. It sounds like, well, is he exalted by being crucified or exalted by being glorified? And the answer is yes, both. That the moment that Jesus was hung up was glory. Was glory. How often in the Bible, when you read about sacrifice and suffering, it's attached to glory. The sufferings of this present life are not worthy to be compared to the glory to be revealed in us. And you can find many, many verses where it talks about suffering and glory in the same passage, that they're connected. And that was his glory, and because he did that, God glorified him. So really, being there was glorious. Painful, horrible, but a glorious sacrifice of God's love. All of the feasts picture God's love through Jesus Christ. And that is the Lamb of Love. That was God's Passover. The Bible does not call it your Passover. He doesn't say your Passover. He always said, you shall not leave the flesh of my Passover, God says. Yes, they took it out of their flock, but God said, that's my lamb. That's my sacrifice. That's my Passover. He's the one who made the sacrifice. And so we're going to look through here. Notice the Messiah is sacrificed, then exalted. But now drop down to the last paragraph. And that is the last three verses of Isaiah 53, verses 10 through 12. Same basic meaning. The Messiah is sacrificed, then exalted. See that? Now, if we go back to the second paragraph, which is Isaiah 53, verses 1 through 3, the Messiah is falsely judged and rejected. And notice the fourth paragraph is the same. Those three verses. The Messiah is falsely judged and rejected. Now, in Hebrew poetry, often if you had inverse parallelism, that is, it will go one way up and the other way down, then what is right at the point in the middle is considered the most important. That is, you work your way up through parallelism, then you work your way down. But what's right in the middle is considered, in Hebrew poetry, the important point. So let's read this. And I hope that in reading it, it gives us a little more. I know you know this. You don't actually have to know that this is poetry to get a lot out of it. But I just thought you might find it interesting and think about it as you're reading. I find this very inspiring. I like to read this or Psalm 22, especially when I come to the Passover. And Renee and I are keeping the Passover in Memphis. They don't have many elders over that direction. Fred Nance, who's in Little Rock, and he's got three congregations, and there are only two of them are elders. You don't have to be an elder to conduct the Passover, but he would like that, so we're going there for Passover and the first day of unleavened bread, and we're very much looking forward to it. But let's read, and we'll kind of notice, the Messiah is sacrificed and exalted. Isaiah 52, verse 13 through 15. See, my servant. Notice the S is capitalized because the translator, by the way, that's not out of the Hebrew, but the translators realized it is talking about Jesus. So deity, they often would give the capital letter to begin. My servant shall prosper. It sounds good, doesn't it? He shall be highly exalted. Now, the problem is that means lifted up. How was he lifted up? Now, shall be lifted up. He was lifted up on a cross. Or a stake, if you prefer that. The Greek means stake. However, it was the Romans doing it, and they called it crux, which meant cross. So, and they're the ones who did it. Anyway, it's not the, apparently just a, like a T is the way that they usually did it. Although they like to change it up just to torture people in unique ways. He shall be highly exalted or lifted up. Yet many shall be amazed when they see him. Yes, even far off, foreign nations and their kings, they shall stand dumbfounded, speechless in his presence. For they shall see and understand what they had not been told before. I mean, to think that God would come and die, come in the flesh, and suffer and die. I mean, it sort of takes our breath too, doesn't it? That's why we have for so many years taken the Passover so solemnly. And it is a solemn time in a way, but it's also a time of rejoicing in God's mercy and love. For they shall see and understand what they had not been told before. They shall see my servant beaten. So he's talking about him being exalted, but also sacrificed. My servant beaten and bloodied, so disfigured, one would scarcely know it was a person standing there. So shall he cleanse many nations. So the Messiah is sacrificed and then exalted. Now the last portion will have the same thing. Let's drop to the last paragraph. Isaiah 53, verses 10 through 12. But it was the Lord's good plan to bruise him and fill him with grief. See how that ties in with what we read in Isaiah 52? However, when his soul has been made an offering for sin, then he shall have a multitude of children, many heirs. He shall live again, and God's program shall prosper in his hands. And when he sees all that is... That's probably speaking of the Father. When the Father sees all that is accomplished by the anguish of his soul, he shall be satisfied. The Father will be satisfied with what he sees Jesus do. And because of what he has experienced, my righteous servant shall make many to be counted righteous before God, for he shall bear all their sins. Therefore, I will give him the honors of one who is mighty and great. See how that he is sacrificed then exalted. Give him the honors of one who is mighty and great because he has poured out his soul unto death. He was counted as a sinner, and he bore the sins of many, and he pled with God for sinners. See how the first three and the last three sort of go together? Now, let's go back up to the second paragraph. The Messiah is falsely judged and rejected. Falsely judged and rejected. Isaiah 53, verses 1 to 3. But oh, how few believe it! Who will listen? To whom will God reveal his saving power? In God's eyes, he, Jesus, was like a tender green shoot sprouting from a root in dry and sterile ground. That was Israel. That was Judah. Spiritually bereft. And Jesus was like a tender green shoot sprouting from a root in dry and sterile ground. But in our eyes, there was no attractiveness at all. He was not like a Saul, tall, head and shoulders above the other men, good looking. That might give some of us men who are small, not all that good looking, a little hope, huh? He probably was a whole lot more buff than most of us because he was, back then, a carpenter, had a lot to do. That also applied to laying rocks and buildings with with rocks and mud and bricks. In our eyes, there was no attractiveness at all. Nothing to make us want him. We despised him. See, falsely judged, rejected. We despised him and rejected him. A man of sorrows, acquainted with bitterest grief. Now is the time for us to sing from the Messiah. He was despised. Aren't you glad? I'm not going to go through that. Rejected. Yes. Thank you, Nick. Shaking his head. He's glad. Nick's glad that I'm not going to sing it all the way through. And a man of sorrows. We despised him. Rejected him. Now that it did happen to him. Not everybody. Even his own disciples turned their back on him in fear. And we might say, how could they do that? You know, as if we, you know. Of course, Peter thought, I wouldn't do that. And you and I might think, we wouldn't do that. A man of sorrows, acquainted with bitterest grief. We turned our backs on him and looked the other way when he went by. He was despised and we didn't care. Now, that was the majority. Now let's go down to the fourth paragraph, Isaiah 53, verses 7 to 9, which is going to be the reflection, the parallel. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he never said a word. Well, he didn't say much, only when he was adjured. I mean, when the high priest said, I adjure you, and when the high priest said, you have to tell, then he followed and obeyed the high priest, because the high priest had an office that he had to obey, that as long as the high priest didn't tell him to sin. Yet he never said a word. He was brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is dumb, so he stood silent before the ones condemning him. And Pilate was amazed that he wouldn't answer when all these accusations were made. From prison and trial, they led him away to his death. But who among the people of that day realized it was their sins that he was dying for? That he was suffering their punishment? How many realized that he was being punished for them, for us? He was buried like a criminal, but in a rich man's grave. But he had done no wrong and had never spoken an evil word. Never spoken an evil word. Now the center is the third paragraph. Switch. The Messiah takes our place. We'll start off. Yet it was our grief he bore. This is a switch. Our sorrows that weighed him down. And we thought his troubles were a punishment from God for his own sins. Now that's the majority. I mean, the ones who were saying, crucify him. Not some of them. The poor of the flock didn't feel that way, but they were very few. Here's the central verse. Here is the center verse in the center paragraph of this parallelism, inverse parallelism. By the way, there are a lot of places in the Psalms and in the prophets that are inverse parallelism, but we don't notice it. But he was wounded and bruised for our sins. He was beaten that we might have peace. He was lashed and we were healed. By his stripes, we were healed. And continuing on, we, every one of us, have strayed away like sheep. We who left God's paths to follow our own. Yet God laid on him the guilt and sins of every one of us. Isn't that, I mean, when you think of it, what he went through for you, as Dr. Zimmerman used to say, what's your name? Some of you, how many of you remember Dr. Z? We always call him Dr. Z saying that. What's your name? Well, I hope that, I mean, I'm not telling you anything. I don't think this is telling you anything that you hadn't already read in those. It may give you a little bit of insight into God's poetry, in the Hebrew poetry, which God inspired. But the lesson was already there and was already inspiring right out of the King James or New King James or whatever translation you'd been reading. You already saw that. But I think I just wanted to bring that out because the title of this sermon is Happy Passover. Now, I thought about saying the joy of Passover, but I just thought Happy Passover would be something a little more unique. So anyway, we were discussing this morning, what title should I give it? And that's what we sort of came up with. All right, we do have time to go to Psalm 32. My wife said, I have notes. I said, this is the only notes I brought today. I mean, pretty simple when all you're going to do is go to this right here. And if there's time, Psalm 32. And if then there's time, there's Psalm 22, which I think, didn't you cover Psalm 22? You covered it. You mentioned it, I think, a little bit in your sermon. I think you at least referred to it. Okay. You did refer, as I recall, Ron, to the in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, where it talks about the body of Christ, not discerning the body of Christ, that there are two possible meanings for that. As I recall, you mentioned that the actual physical body of Jesus Christ and the sacrifice that was given, and the church, so I've heard people go both ways on that, and I think seems like you mentioned that it could be both. So anyway, we were discussing that this morning. Well, here it is. Let me tell you, this is not my favorite passage anymore. My favorite passage after years and years and years of being a pastor. You know, as a pastor, you get to be with people at the very happiest times. You know, blessing little children, marriages. And you get to be with people at the very saddest of times. The loss of a father, mother, husband, wife, sometimes child. And that's the hardest. And so my favorite verse is Revelation 21, verse 4, where it says he'll come down and wipe away every tear. God the Father. That's how he feels about our tears. But when I was first baptized, and I took a while, I prayed and prayed and prayed, asked God to forgive me. And most everybody in my class at Ambassador College was baptized before the Passover. And I mean, I was 19 and a lot of them were 18 and had been baptized already. And I was one of the ones who had not, because I had the mistaken feeling that I just would never be good enough to ever be baptized. And of course, I would never be good enough. It's only when you realize you're bad enough but you're sorry about it. And I didn't even ask to be baptized in a sense. Rod Meredith had heard that I was not going to come back to college the next year, and another student, August Rubrecht, who was a freshman, and so this was in 1960, and so he came to me out of kindness And he said, Fred, I hear that you and August are not planning on coming back to college. And I said, I don't know about August. Matter of fact, he didn't come back. And he became a professor up in Wisconsin. A nice guy, but just not called. His mother, his sisters stayed with the truth, but he didn't. But I said, I don't know about August, but I am definitely wanting to come back. And I've been, and I finally, because he came to me, I screwed up enough courage to say, I'm considering asking about baptism. He said, well, call my secretary and make an appointment for tomorrow morning. So I called, and he counseled with me, and he baptized me that day. Now, the college was so small when I went there in 1959, 1960, that everybody knew who was baptized and who was not. And so I was kind of a smart mouth individual. Can you believe that? And not real serious, people thought. So they weren't so surprised that I hadn't been baptized. This joker, this clown, class clown. So anyway, he baptized me, and then I walked down to Terrace Drive out of the lower gardens there and began walking down to my dorm, Manor Del Mar, dripping wet, and it just hit me. All my sins were gone. Everything I'd ever done. Every bad thing. That God had washed it away. And I just burst into tears. And students walking down Terrace Drive. So here was Fred walking along, dripping wet and crying. And they all knew exactly what had happened. And would come over, and they wouldn't say, what happened, Fred? They didn't say that. They just said, congratulations. Now, I still look back on that. And this was my favorite scripture at the time. How happy is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. How happy is the man to whom the Lord does not impute iniquity, and in whose spirit there is no guile. Isn't that a happy thought? Isn't the Passover a happy, happy occasion? The days of unleavened bread, being called out of this mess, being called out of slavery. I was in slavery. I mean, it wasn't my parents' fault. They were in slavery to this world. And we were keeping Christmas and Easter and Sunday and believed in an ever-burning hellfire. My immortal soul, and thinking that everybody had to be converted now, and if they died not being converted, they were gone. It was over. No chance. I mean, God called me out of this world. And when I first learned, you remember when you first learned that God is not trying to save the whole world right now? I mean, what a relief. What a relief. And then to find what God's reward for us is. Now, I love harp music. I love harp concertos. So when you're ready to play the solo part in a harp concerto, I'll hum the orchestra. And you can play. Anyway, I really like Tchaikovsky's harp concerto. Have you heard? You need to. If you haven't heard it, you need to. It's lovely. But anyway, to be called out of this world, out of this world, and to know that these people are not all lost. What a joy. That is one of the most profound things, to find God's plan of salvation for everybody. I mean, that God intentionally is allowing Satan to blind the whole world. That he put, who put the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the garden? Who allowed Satan to go into the garden? He knew everything. And it says Jesus was the lamb slain from the foundation of the earth. God knew there was going to have to be a lamb. So it's all according to his plan. Nothing's lost. And to realize that it's all God's love. This whole creation is God's nursery of love. Just like parents who are planning on having a child, and they will decorate this nursery, and they will get bassinet and things, you know, a crib, and decorate it with all these beautiful little things for babies, and get excited about it, and there's a baby shower and all of that. God's in love with us. And he created all of this out of love for us in this plan. And the other thing that is so amazing, as I mentioned, is to find God wants us to be in his family. I mean, glorified as Jesus. Just amazing. And then to be delivered from our sins. Well, sometimes we do things and we're so embarrassed. Have you ever been so embarrassed of something that you said or you did, and you go to God and you just feel too embarrassed to even say anything? I mean, I've gotten on my knees and just was silent for 5 minutes because I felt so stupid and awful and rotten for something I had said or done. Usually something I said. And something prideful. You know, not humble. And then realize later, that was just plain pride and ego to have said that. How stupid. How selfish. Well, when I kept silent, my bones grew old through my groaning all the day long. Now notice this is, remember I said that this is poetry and it will be hyperbole. Sort of like Psalm 22, it says, all my bones are out of joint. That's how he felt. That was not meant to be literal. Sometimes it's hard to tell whether something's literal or it's figurative. But when he says, all my bones are out of joint, every bone, and my heart is melted in me like wax. You know, sometimes, haven't you felt that way? That's what it means. It's hyperbole. It's poetry. And God allows that because he's telling a lesson. So my bones grew old through my groaning all the day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was turned into the drought of summer. Now he's talking about how he felt. See, this is poetry that he's giving. Now, here, just to give you a little example of parallelism is right in verse 5. I acknowledged my sin to you, and my iniquity I have not hidden. See, he says the same thing twice, just in a little different way. And you'll see that often throughout the Psalms, throughout all of the poetic sections. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord. Actually, that's three times. I acknowledge my sin to you. My iniquity I have not hidden. I will confess my transgressions to the Lord. And you forgave the iniquity of my sin. Interesting way to put it. Not just you forgave my iniquity. Not just you forgave my sin. But you forgave the iniquity of my sin. It was bad. For this cause, everyone who is godly shall pray to you. In a time when you may be found. Surely in a flood of great waters, now that's, this is hyperbole, in a flood of great waters. Now, we might actually get into a flood of great waters sometime, but most of us get into an emotional flood of great waters or trials that he's picturing here as if they were great waters. This is a metaphor. They shall not come near him. You are my hiding place. You shall preserve me from trouble. Saying the same thing twice there. Hiding place, preserve from trouble. You shall surround me with songs of deliverance. And we sing songs of deliverance. You'll, on Passover night, probably sing a song of deliverance. There are so many songs of deliverance in our hymn book. I will instruct you and teach you in the way you should go. I will guide you with my eye. Do not be like the horse or the mule, which have no understanding, which must be harnessed with bit and bridle, else they will not come near you. So you got to tame this horse and this mule with a bit and bridle. Many sorrows shall be to the wicked, but he who trusts in the Lord, mercy shall surround him. Like the song, like the sermon that we had on, if we forgive, we'll be forgiven, or the sermonette, if we have mercy, we'll receive mercy. Mercy shall surround him. Be glad in the Lord and rejoice, you righteous. That's the Passover. This is I like to read this for the Passover. Okay. So right now, Renee and I are going through the Gospels, the accounts, reading the last chapters of each Gospel. Each one covers a little bit different. And so we've done Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So we have yet to do John. And let me say this. I may not have a chance to say it to you. I will be here the next two Sabbaths, but that after the last day of unleavened bread, I'll tell you what I like to study. Remember how in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, he says all these things happened to them as examples upon whom the ends of the world have come. And he says they went through the Red Sea and they came out, but God wasn't pleased with all of them because many of them fell in the wilderness because they did this and they did that. And these are all examples for us. So take heed. So those were written for me and for you. So I like, after the last day of unleavened bread, to go through the rest of the examples. In Numbers, God says, you have tried me these 10 times. And I went back and could only find 9. Now they tried him after that also. But I went back and I thought, and I remember Mr. Petty said, now maybe I should give a sermon on the 10 trials. I thought, well, I hope so. I can't find but 9 of them. But I think I went back, and he never did. But I went back and I finally decided that there were 2 times that they tried him in chapter 16 of Exodus, where he gave them the Sabbath. I think they tried him twice. It sounds like just one person. One or two people went out, a few went out and did something, but it angered Moses and angered the Lord, so I think it was more than one or two people. So I'm taking those as trials. If any of you, I find going back, since those were written for me as examples, to learn, to warn me, that I like to go through after the days of unleavened bread. And then, of course, after you go through, a lot of Exodus is just about detail on building the tabernacle, which can get a bit repetitious because it says, here's what you should do, and then it says, here's what they did. And it's pretty much the same thing. But then also the book of Numbers goes through their rebellion. And think about, could I do this? Could this happen to me? See, it says where they tempted Christ, and so many fell in one day, 23,000. Anybody here happen to remember with fiery serpents? Anybody happen to remember how they tempted Christ when they were killed with fiery serpents? Most people don't remember. It doesn't say right there what they did. You know what they did? They got tired of manna. Yeah, that's it. They were, you know, I would like wafers made with honey. But if I had it for breakfast and then lunch and then supper and then breakfast and then lunch and then supper, we're so spoiled. Would you like to have chicken tonight? No, I had it yesterday. Would you like to have lamb? No, I don't like lamb. It's a little too strong. Would you like to have Mexican? I had Mexican for lunch. You know, well, the Mexicans did too. And, you know, we're so spoiled. We complain if we have to eat the same meat twice in a row. You know, well, they would leftovers. Man, I don't want the. They wanted to go back and have the fish and the cucumbers and the leeks and the onions. I like fish and cucumbers and leeks and onions. And if we were out there just eating wafers, I'd kind of think, man, I'd like to have some cucumbers. And, you know, we are those people. We are those people. And they tempted the Lord by complaining that they had the same food all the time. And we are so much their descendants. Be glad in the Lord and rejoice, you righteous, and shout for joy, all you upright in heart. Okay, there's not time to go to Psalm 22, which is fine. You can go yourself and read it. It is poetry. It was Jesus' thoughts on the stake. I will just say one thing. Let me turn to Psalm 22, just in case you're... I'll give you my personal take, and this is the Minority Report, and you'll find every now and then it will be mentioned, and I don't say they're wrong, that Jesus, when he was on the cross, was surprised that God the Father turned his back on him. Now, I will give a different take on that. I don't think he felt God turned his back on him. I think he was reading Psalm 22, which he himself inspired. And he knew it was about himself on the stake. So he started off there. But notice also verse 24. Now, verse 1 is poetic. It's how we feel. Have you ever felt God forsook you? But did God ever forsake you? No. But we feel it. And that's the point of verse 1. Why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me, from the words of my groaning? Things are going so bad. I'm sick. My kid is sick. Somebody else is sick. Finances are in the drain. You know, I'm going nuts here, down here. Where are you, Father? I've been praying to you, and nothing has happened. You've forsaken me. No, he hasn't forsaken us. Verse 24. For he has not despised nor abhorred the affliction of the afflicted, nor has he hidden his face from him. But when he cried to him, he heard. This was written by David, but it was about both David and the Messiah and you and me. Because we felt that way too. So it's poetry. I mean, it says, for instance, in here, I am a worm and no man. That's poetry. That's verse 6. Verse 14, I am poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It's melted within me. That's poetry. But we have to understand we feel forsaken, but God has never forsaken us. So Jesus knew this was about him. It's beautiful to read of the things that he thought of. And I wonder when he says that... In verse 12, many bulls have surrounded me. Strong bulls of Bashan have encircled me. Bashan was a high mountainous region. It's the Golan Heights. And the grass grows very well there because they get more rain up in that high area, in the desert area. It gets more rain. So they got good grass, and the bulls grew very well and big and strong. I'm wondering if this is symbolic of Satan and some of the demons. And about they gape it as roaring, raging and roaring lions. If while Jesus was hanging there, he saw and knew the spirits, the demons, who I'm sure were all gathered around to watch, to see what he would do. So I don't know. Is that symbolic of that? I don't know. Well, as I say, we'll be here a couple more weeks. She has contract on her home. and we expect to close, if it goes through, and the inspections toward the end of April or the 1st of May. And we'll live wherever she wants. Now, don't blame me.